has any funny hats. He raises his arm in the air like a general giving marching orders to his troops.
To the maternity suite, he cries.
To the maternity suite,
everyone shouts back in unison. Like a crazed horde of barbarians, we throng down the hospital hallway, hooting and hollering, scaring the shit out of several unsuspecting nurses and doctors on the way. Blinking up at me in hazy, slack-mouthed confusion, like someone awakening after a long night of hard drinking, the creature snuggled in a pink blankie in my arms is so astonishingly beautiful, I can only stare at it in silent awe. Her, I correct myself. I stare at her, little Abigail, feeling as if everything I thought I knew about life is complete and total bullshit. Today is a day of two huge firsts for me. I cried, and I fell in love. With a baby of all things. Next thing you know, I'll be wearing sweatpants in public and taking in stray cats. She's so perfect, I whisper, marveling at the teeny fingers gripped around my thumb. She has her father's startling eyes, clear golden amber, the color of fine whiskey. But everything else about her is pure Chloe, from her rosebud lips to her long, elegant limbs, to the wispy blonde curls on the top of her head, fine as chick fluff. Well, she did get one other thing from her father. She's huge.
This kid's gonna be an athlete,
muses Barney, looking at Abby over my shoulder.
Swimmer, maybe. Or volleyball player.
Or basketball star,
pipes in Nico.
How long did you say she was?
He looks at Chloe. She's propped on a pile of pillows in the hospital bed, smiling dreamily. Glowing and gorgeous, like no person who's just shoved 9 pounds and 5 ounces of infant through her birth canal has any right to be. She says,
like half a mile, I think.
AJ, sitting in the chair next to Chloe's bed and finally composed, chuckles.
61 centimeters.
Nico does the math faster than the rest of us.
Jesus, that's 2 feet of baby, brother.
Equal parts horrified and impressed, we all stare at Chloe. She says,
you're gonna feel even worse for me when I tell you that I was too dilated to get an epidural. I had her with no drugs.
Fanning himself and softly moaning, Kenji sinks into a chair on the opposite side of the room. Kat glares at AJ. He can't see it, but it doesn't stop her. She barks,
I have one word for you, Mr. Edwards. Diamonds.
Smiling, AJ lifts Chloe's hand to his lips and gently kisses it.
Already on it, Auntie Kat.
Hearing him say the words, Auntie Kat, makes her lower lip quiver. Mollified, she says,
all right then.
Her voice breaks over the last word. Grinning, Nico pulls her into his arms and murmurs something into her ear that sounds like Big Softy.
Can I hold her?
We've all taken turns holding the baby except Brody, who now stands in front of me with his arms out, wiggling his fingers in a gimme gesture. I carefully place Abby into his arms and then step back and watch him as he starts to coo down at her, rocking her gently and making funny faces. He appears to be very comfortable holding a baby. I wonder how close he is with his sister and her kids. Then I wonder what the hell is happening in my uterus, because I could swear that watching him cuddle that child just made my ovaries twinge. I abruptly turn away. Thomas, more champagne, please.
Coming up.
When he hands me a full glass of bubbly, I ignore the way Kat is looking sideways at me with narrowed eyes.
That woman should be spying for the CIA.
Well, I think we'll get going and let you get some rest,
says Chris, speaking for himself and Ethan, who seem to operate as one unit, always arriving and departing together.
They approach Chloe's bed and say their goodbyes, each of them bending to give her a kiss on the cheek, then bumping fists with AJ, and then trade hugs with Nico, Kat, and Barney. They then shake hands with Thomas and Elizabeth, who are both high as kites with pride and look as if they might go out dancing after this. From his chair, Kenji lifts his bejeweled left hand in Chris and Ethan's general direction. Instead of the kiss it appears Kenji is expecting, Chris shakes his pinky finger. Grinning, Ethan does the same. Kenji heaves a sigh and waves them off like a pair of misbehaving children. Brody asks them, "See you at the housewarming next Saturday?" Chris nods with so much enthusiasm I worry his neck might snap.
"Dude, can't wait to see the new pad. We'll totally be there." "What can we bring?"
chimes in Ethan.
"Besides hookers."
At the same time, Kat and Chloe shout, "No hookers!" Startling Elizabeth so much, she jumps, sloshing champagne down the front of her Chanel jacket.
"Only kidding, dudes," says Ethan, laughing. "Chill."
"I'll give you chill," growls Chloe.
AJ puts his face into his hands and tries unsuccessfully to smother his laughter.
"You don't have to bring anything," says Brody, grinning. "I'm all set."
He walks to Chloe and carefully places Abby in her arms, then turns back to the guys.
4 o'clock, okay?"
Ethan and Chris agree, trade fist bumps with Brody and hugs with me, and take their leave. Which is when Brody turns to me and pins me in his stare.
"You're coming, right?"
Is it me, or was that a double entendre? And why am I hoping it was?
God, I need to get away from this person as soon as possible.
I finish my glass of champagne in one swallow. "I didn't realize I was invited."
"Of course you're invited,"
he says as if I'm an idiot.
"You're core."
"Core?" He nods, making me admire the way his hair falls over the collar of his shirt. It's really quite pretty hair, glossy and thick, very soft-looking, meant to be touched. Oh, for fuck's sake, I should just jump out the window and put myself out of my misery. I shoot a desperate glance at Thomas to see if he'll read my mind and offer a refill on my champagne, but he's too distracted with his new granddaughter at the moment, so I'm on my own with my raging hormones. Brody says,
"Yeah, core, you know."
He makes a lazy circle in the air with his forefinger.
"Part of the inner circle."
And now, for the coup d'etat, my vagina decides it would very much like to get acquainted with Brody's finger, because hearing him say core and inner circle in conjunction with that clockwise motion of his tapered finger sends a bolt of pure lust through me, making my pussy actually throb. Finally, my brain has had enough of this nonsense. It shouts at me in no uncertain terms, "Stop." Attraction is one thing. I understand attraction. It's simple, it's straightforward, everyone knows what to expect. Bada bing, bada boom, now get your ass out of my bedroom. What I feel for Brody goes so far beyond attraction, it's not even in the same universe. Which is exactly why it's so dangerous. And why I need to stop this madness before it has a chance to get worse. My smile is pinched. Avoiding his searching gaze, I say coolly, "Thank you for the invitation, but I'm busy next Saturday." I turn stiffly away from him, set my empty champagne glass on a nearby console, go over to Chloe and kiss her on the forehead. "I'm leaving too, but I'll be back tomorrow, okay?" Chloe nods. "I'm not sure how long we'll be in here, so give me a call first. They might let me go home later tonight." I'm aghast. "Already?" She chuckles. "It's not a hotel, Grace. Plus, I'm anxious to get into my own bed." "Oh, no," I cry, remembering something. Chloe looks startled. "What's wrong?" I never checked the thread count on the sheets or bought you candles from the gift store.
Chloe shakes her head and laughs. The things you worry about.
I want you to be comfortable.
Blue eyes shining, she gazes up at me. Her smile is the definition of angelic. She says softly, Oh, Gracie, I'm more comfortable than I've ever been in my entire life.
I know she's not talking about the bed. I stare at them for a moment, my beautiful friend and her perfect baby, the man who literally took a bullet for them seated by their side, and realize with a pang in my chest that today's firsts are still coming. Because I'm experiencing another emotion I've never felt before. It's ugly, cold, and dangerous, like a snake unfurling inside my belly. I recoil from it exactly as I would if it were a hissing snake about to lash out and sink its fangs into my leg. It's longing so sharp I can taste it, wanting so deep I feel it in my bones. It's jealousy. I'm flooded with shame and confusion. This isn't me, this person. This person who sheds tears and feels envy and can't manage to control her hormones around an attractive man. I don't like this person. Whoever she is, I have to lock her in a box and throw away the key because she's far too volatile to be trusted. I force a smile. Love you, honey. Chloe smiles back.
Love you, too.
I round the bed and give AJ a hug.
You did so good,
I whisper into his ear. His expression is calm, proud, and extremely satisfied. He squeezes the arm I've got around his shoulders.
I didn't do anything. I'm just the luckiest motherfucker on the planet.
From behind us, Elizabeth scolds.
Language, dear.
I go over to her and Thomas, give them both hugs, and say my goodbyes. I do the same with Nico and Kat, who is watching me a little too closely for comfort, so I escape with a breezy smile as fast as I can. And then I say goodbye to Kenji. Aunt Kenji, I pronounce, looking down at him in his chair. You were fantastic today. I'm very proud of you.
You are,
he replies, preening.
Yes. You didn't make it all about you, you didn't complain much, and you didn't faint once.
His eyes grow misty. He starts blinking rapidly, as if he's got a speck of dust lodged under a lid.
Oh, lovey, that's so sweet of you. I don't care what anyone says. You aren't a man-eating ball buster with a shard of ice in her chest where her heart is supposed to be.
And that, folks, is Kenji's version of a sincere compliment. Thank you. Considering the source, that means a lot. I lean down and kiss the cheek he offers. When I turn for the door, I come face to face with Barney and Brody. They stand blocking the doorway, looking at me eagerly like they're in line to have a book autographed by their favorite erotica author. I say cautiously, Guys, nice seeing you. Brody says,
You too, Grace. It's always great to see you.
He puts emphasis on the word see. Combined with the twinkle in his eye and the way one corner of his mouth tugs up, I know he's referring to our brief interlude in Nico's bathroom, where he backed me up against the counter and tried to kiss me. I told him to get lost and gave him a laundry list of reasons why I wasn't interested, but not before spending a decent amount of time leering at the bulge in his jeans. I mean, I might be cold, but I'm not dead. Barney says,
Yep, and, I wasn't kidding before. If you ever need a hand around the office.
He shrugs his broad shoulders, leaving the rest of his sentence dangling there between us like a dare. Brody's expression sours. He shoots a sharp glance at Barney and then focuses back on me.
If your plans change on Saturday, I'd love to have you.
An explicit picture of Brody having me pops into my head,
complete with an audio soundtrack of our pleasured groans and the sound of a headboard slamming against a wall as Brody fucks me from behind while I'm on my knees in bed, my face buried in a pillow.
Great goddess of peckermelons, get me out of this room. Now.
I say primly, sorry, I have a date. The smile on Barney's face is a little too smug. It irks me. Just because I'm shooting Brody down doesn't mean I want anyone else to be happy about it. I turn to Barney. And I was kidding before. I always work alone. Thanks for the offer, though. I shoulder past them both, retrieve my handbag from the little table just inside the entrance, and then leave without so much as a backward glance. I walk away briskly, my heels clicking against the linoleum floor. Just before I'm out of earshot, I hear Barney chuckle.
Is she always that hard to read?
Brody sighs.
Man, you have no fucking idea.
I walk a little faster before the wistful tone in his voice makes me turn around and run back in. 4. A few hours later, I'm flat on my back in Marcus's bed, stuffed to the gills with his thick cock, taking it like a champ while he bangs the living daylights out of me, when he suddenly stops thrusting and sighs. What's wrong? I ask, perplexed. Why are you stopping?
Because if I wanted to have sex alone, Grace, I'd just jerk myself off.
He stares down at me with his brows lifted, daring me to contradict him. I don't bother with the denial. I'm many things, but a woman who fakes an interest in sex isn't one of them. You're right. I'm sorry. My head is just somewhere else. It wasn't when I got here half an hour ago, but as soon as Marcus slid inside me, it was as if I mentally went offline. I've never composed a to-do list in my head during sex before, but here we are.
God, that's depressing.
I'm filled with sudden empathy for one of my patients, who shared with me that she dislikes sex so much she recites Edgar Allan Poe's narrative poem, The Raven, while her husband is fucking her just to keep her mind off how disgusting she finds him. Marcus offers,
"You want me to go down on you?"
"You already did that."
"So you want me to go down on you again?"
I unhook my ankles from around his back, give him a friendly pat on his muscular shoulder, and shake my head. I don't think it will help. I can tell I'm not going to get there no matter what we try. It's not you. He chuckles.
I know, but thanks for the vote of confidence.
He withdraws from my body, rolls to his side, then sits up on the edge of the mattress. With a practiced hand, he removes the condom from his erection and tosses it into the trash can next to the bed. Then he slowly runs a hand over his smoothly shaved head. He was an athlete in college, running back for USC's football team, and over the past decade has kept his athlete's physique. I admire the way his muscles ripple in his back with the movement of his arm. I admire how beautiful his skin is. Shining a deep burnished brown in the low light, like polished wood. I admire the pure masculine physicality of him, his broad hands and strong thighs and thick neck. And I admit to myself that while Marcus is in every way a perfect specimen of male beauty, at the moment, I feel about as much enthusiasm for him as I'd feel if my doctor called to schedule me for a colonoscopy. This is not good. If my libido deserts me, I'll have to find something else to occupy all my free time. And fuck if I'm about to take up knitting. Marcus rises from the bed and lumbers into the bathroom. Without turning on the light, he runs the faucet and splashes water on his face. He leans over the counter for a moment, his hands braced against the marble.
You want to go get something to eat?
I sit up, find my dress and underwear scattered on the floor, and step into my panties. No thanks. I think I'll just hit it. I've got an early meeting tomorrow.
I put on my bra, zip up my dress, step into my heels, and comb my fingers through my hair. When I'm finished, I turn to find Marcus leaning against the door jamb with his arms folded across his chest, watching me. He says softly,
"You don't always have to do that, you know."
"Do what?"
"Run away."
When I don't respond, he pushes off the door and comes to stand in front of me. He pulls me against his chest and winds his strong arms around me.
"You could stay the night for once. It wouldn't kill you."
It probably would, but I decline to share that opinion with him. "You know I don't do sleepovers, Marcus."
"I know. And you don't talk about your past, and you don't date anyone longer than a month."
His tone isn't accusing, only factual, but I find myself feeling defensive anyway. I say into his chest,
"I thought we were on the same page about all that."
"We were." He pulls away and looks at me.
"Until I realized our one-month stand is almost up."
I frown, trying to remember when we met.
"It is? Honestly, I haven't been keeping track."
Marcus brushes my hair off my face.
"Yeah? That sounds like a good thing. I must be keeping you too preoccupied to watch the calendar."
His smile comes on slow and sultry. It was the first thing I noticed about him when we met, apart from his sheer size. He's got a killer smile, totally confident, totally sexy, totally effective on its intended target. I'm always amused when we're out somewhere together at how easily he can make a woman swoon with nothing but a well-timed flash of that rakish grin. Absent-mindedly, I reach down and fondle his cock. It's still stiff. "How many days do we have left?"
"6."
His voice is thick. I know he loves it when I've got my hands on him. He loves to watch me jerk him off, loves the contrast in the colors of our skin, my paleness against his darkness, my small soft palms gripping his big hard dick. I sigh. He really is a good one. Too bad our time is almost up. Suddenly he takes my head in his hands and kisses me, hard. When he breaks away, he says,
"Let's renegotiate our deal. Tack on a few extra days, see how it goes. What do you say?"
Cue the sound of screeching brakes. "Marcus, please tell me you're not catching feelings for me." He blinks, the picture of innocence.
"Feelings? What are those?"
When I narrow my eyes, he sighs.
"I like you, yes, I'll admit that. We're very similar people. We're both focused on our careers. We both love sex. Neither one of us wants a relationship. And to be totally honest, I haven't found that particular combo before. So I'm reluctant to give it up. That's it."
He pauses. His eyes search my face.
"It's your turn to talk now."
"I'm trying to decide if you're telling the truth or just telling me what you think I want to hear." His voice comes husky.
"You've still got my cock in your hands, Grace. Do you have any idea how hard it would be to come up with a convincing lie right now?"
I tip my head back, look at him from beneath my lashes, and lightly squeeze his erection.
"As hard as this?"
He smiles.
"Maybe not that hard."
"I should take care of this before I leave," I say, squeezing him again. His voice is unsteady when he asks,
"Are you trying to distract me so you don't have to answer my question?"
I don't bother with an answer. I simply sink to my knees, apply my mouth, and get on with a distraction that never fails to bring inconvenient conversations with men to an abrupt end. The night is crystal clear and cold. I drive with the windows of my Lexus down, letting the icy wind sting my cheeks and whip my hair, sweep the cobwebs from my head. I take the long way home, avoiding the I-405 that's always bumper to bumper, even at this late hour on a Sunday evening, and take the winding two-lane canyon road instead. It snakes through the Santa Monica Mountains, linking the inland valleys to the beach communities of Malibu and Pacific Palisades. It's the longer route, even with the freeway traffic, but I need to be alone with my thoughts. And, truth be told, I dread going to sleep. The nightmares never really went away, but they're much more frequent this time of year. In the weeks leading up to St. Patrick's Day, they appear almost every night with relentless ferocity. Violent ordeals of screams and carnage that leave me shaking and sweating when I bolt upright in bed, staring wildly into the dark with my heart like a jackhammer inside my chest. Nothing has cured them, not therapy or medication or time. Everyone has their demons. Mine come out to play at night. In the first months after the accident, the nightmares paralyzed me. It was like reliving the worst moment of your life over and over again, in surround sound and technicolor. I slowly learned to accept them the way you accept that you have cancer. There was a lot of anger and denial at first, a lot of fear and bargaining, a desperate search for cures and answers that eventually yielded nothing but exhaustion and ultimately the realization that I was no longer in control. Sleep was no longer my friend. My own mind was a traitor to me. Summer and fall are better, quieter. The demons rest. But for me, the waning days of winter and the early days of spring are a living hell. Pacific Coast Highway is gorgeous in the moonlight. The ocean is as black as ink, as restless as I feel. The traffic is light, so I fly up the coast, listening to Nina Simone sing the blues in her raspy contralto. By the time I get to my building in Century City, it's nearly midnight. I slow as I approach the high metal entry gate and wave to the guard in the security booth.
"Evening, Miss Stanton,"
he says, tipping his hat. "Hi, Roy. How are you?" He nods, smiling.
"Better than I deserve. Have a good one, ma'am."
He waves me through. In the portico, the valet takes my car. Inside the elegant lobby of glistening glass and marble, the night concierge murmurs hello. Avoiding my reflection in the mirrors that line the walls, I take the private elevator to my floor. The doors open to reveal my darkened condo and a spectacular view of the Los Angeles night skyline through the living room windows beyond. I set my handbag on the console by the door and step out of my heels. I don't turn on the lights. I stand there for a moment in the dark, watching the night sky, all the lights that sparkle like faraway diamonds. I think of all the joy at the hospital today, all the love and warmth and happy tears. Inside my living room, it's as cold and silent as a tomb. At times like this, my loneliness is so raw, so sharp and burning, I have to fight to breathe. This is one of the reasons I chose the career I have. I couldn't help myself. There was no cure for what ailed me, so I wanted to help others who might be going through something similar. I understand what drives people to stay in relationships long after the love is gone. I know why they accept less than they deserve and put up with way too much shit and suffer for years rather than get out. Because loneliness can kill you. And even if it doesn't kill you physically, which it certainly can, disease of the psyche often leads to disease of the flesh. It can kill your soul. Which, in all the ways that count, is actually worse. Just ask me. I pad in my bare feet into the kitchen, flip on the overhead light, pull out a frozen dinner from the freezer, heat it up in the microwave and eat it right out of the plastic tray standing over the sink. Then I go to my bedroom. I wash my face,
brush my teeth, get undressed, and get into bed. I watch television for as long as I can keep my eyes open, switching between late-night talk shows and old movies. Finally, at 3 o'clock a.m., when I can no longer fight sleep, I turn off the TV. Then, staring up at the ceiling, with my hands clenched to fists at my sides, I wait for the darkness to take me. 5. At 1 o'clock the next afternoon, I'm eating a salad at my desk in my office when the phone rings. I pick it up, say, "Grace Stanton speaking," and laugh when the response comes, sharp as a tack. "The Grace Stanton, marriage therapist to the stars, ultimate commitment phobe and dedicated dickaholic." "Dickaholic?" I repeat, grinning. "That's a new one, Kat. Bonus points for creativity." It was either that or cock-gobbling Meritrix. "Meritrix? Have you been reading the dictionary again?" "Aha," she crows, pleased. "You don't know what the word means, do you, Ms. PhD from Stanford University?" I look at the ceiling and sigh. "A Meritrix was a registered prostitute in ancient Rome." In my mind, I see her on the other end of the line, sticking out her tongue and flipping me the bird. "I'm gonna get you one of these times." "In your dreams, princess. And thanks for the compliment, by the way. It's so wonderful to have friends who ring you at work just to call you a whore." "You're not a whore," comes the immediate response. "You just like dick more than any person I've ever met." I smile. "So, technically I'm a slut." She protests. "If you were a man, we wouldn't even be having this conversation." "Hey, you started it." "That's not why I'm calling anyway," she says, changing the subject. "I just wanted to let you know that Chloe was released from the hospital late last night." I stuff a bite of salad into my mouth and say between chews.
"I know. I called this morning and they said she'd checked out."
"So do you want to go visit her after work tonight?"
"Tonight? You don't think we should give her a few days to settle in, spend time alone with AJ and the baby?" Kat snorts.
"Whose idea do you think it was that we come over? AJ has already texted me like 10 times trying to find out how soon we can be there. He's dying to show that baby off to whoever he can. I think he's dragging people in off the street."
"I didn't get any texts from him," I say, surprised.
There's a short pause. Then Kat says, "You might be the only person on Earth he's afraid of." "Oh, please. That man isn't afraid of anything." Kat's response is wry. "I hate to break it to you, Ice Queen, but you have no idea how intimidating you can be. I know a few mobsters who'd shit their pants if they had to go up against you."
"Ice Queen? I'm not sure whether to be insulted or pleased, so I settle on neutral, even if it does sting a little."
"Well, good. It's better to be feared than loved." This time the pause is longer. Softly, Kat asks, "Is it?"
"Oh, shiznits. Here comes the lecture."
"I can't tonight anyway. I've got plans with Marcus. How about tomorrow?"
"You have plans with Marcus? That's like twice this week, right? And you said you had another date with him this coming Saturday?"
I hear the hope in her voice, close my eyes, and pinch the bridge of my nose. It's hard having two best friends who so completely, utterly, and unreservedly believe in true love. Not everyone gets the happily ever after.
"Kat, please don't do that."
"Do what?" she asks, sounding hurt.
"You know what."
"Wanting you to be happy? Why is that so bad?"
"I am happy. We don't all need the white picket fence."
It comes out harsher than I expected,
I hear it in the silence that follows, in her offended little huff, so I backtrack. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the white picket fence. It's just not for me, that's all. You know that. It's how I'm built. It's how you choose to be built, she shoots back. I'm not fighting with you about this, I say firmly. And I'm not defending my personal choices about my love life either. Do you want to go together to Chloe's tomorrow night or not? After a tense pause, in which I count every tick of the clock on the wall, Kat sighs.
You drive me to drink, girlfriend.
Don't blame your chronic alcohol problem on me, dear.
Gah, you're such a bitch.
She says it with love, though, so I know I'm forgiven. Do you want me to drive? I can pick you up around 6.
Fine, see you at 6.
We say goodbye and hang up, but I have a bad feeling this conversation isn't over. The next night, promptly at 6 p.m., I push the button on the call box at the bottom of the long gated drive that leads to Nico and Kat's place in the Hollywood Hills. When the buzzer sounds, I pull through the gate. When I get to the top of the drive, I start to laugh, as I always do when I see their house. The Shack, they jokingly call it. It's an enormous compound of glass and stone, perched on the side of the hill with a spectacular view of the entire Los Angeles basin, from downtown to the sparkling Pacific to Malibu far north. It's about as shack-like as the Taj Mahal. I park next to the fountain in the middle of the circular driveway and head to the front door, a massive slab of redwood twice as tall as I am. It opens before I'm even halfway across the cobblestone drive. Barney stands there waiting. He's looking at me over the rims of a pair of mirrored sunglasses, with his brows lifted and an expression like he hasn't eaten in weeks. Hey there, big boy, I say playfully when I reach the front step. How's it hanging? He smiles, exposing a set of gleaming white teeth.
To my knees, angel face.
Oh my, and I thought that was just a big gun in your pocket.
Oh, it is big, and fully loaded.
We grin at each other.
Your girlfriend's in the kitchen.
Thanks. Then just to see if he'll play, I add, I'd ask you why you're wearing sunglasses indoors, but then you'd probably tell me something dumb like your future is so bright you have to wear shades and I'd lose all respect for you. His smile is blinding. He slides his sunglasses farther down his nose, looks me up and down, and drawls,
I know that's a line from a song. And honestly, sweetheart, it's not your respect I'm interested in.
No? I blink coyly, thoroughly enjoying myself. There's nothing like a little harmless flirting with someone who can give as good as he gets. Then what are you interested in? I half expect him to say something creepy, but he surprises me when he deadpans.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word. Are you listening?
I'm listening.
Plastics.
It's a famous line from a movie. He's testing me to see if I'll get it, which, because I'm a huge film buff, I do. Exactly how do you mean, Mr. McGuire? I answer, playing the part of Dustin Hoffman's character Benjamin. Barney's face lights up.
You know The Graduate?
What, you thought I was just another pretty face?
I thought you were a pretty everything,
he answers instantly.
But getting my stupid movie references makes me think you might actually have a brain, too.
I pretend to be insulted. I'm a licensed therapist, Barney. I'll have you know I have an advanced degree. He's clearly not impressed.
Some of the stupidest people I've met have advanced degrees. Also, therapists are generally as much of a whack job as their patients are.
Usually more. I agree, taking no offense, because he's right.
I'm glad we had this conversation, he
he says with a straight face, nodding. Now I can masturbate to the thought of your enormous brain and not just your beautiful body. I'll feel much better about myself afterward. You know, women's rights and whatnot. I know you ladies like to be taken seriously.
You're fun, I declare, charmed by this Armani-wearing, smart-mouthed thug. Why didn't I know this about you?
Probably on account of the huge cloud of testosterone that surrounds me. Makes it hard to see me through all this.
He swivels his hips and waggles his eyebrows up and down.
Machismo.
I throw back my head and laugh.
Yes, that's definitely it. Now let me in before I throw myself at you and ruin a beautiful friendship.
God damn. Don't tease me like that, woman,
he says, his voice gravelly and his dark eyes alight. You can take it. I place my hand on his broad chest and gently shove. He steps back, grinning, his gaze raking over me, and lets me inside. As I walk by him, I say over my shoulder, I know you're staring at my ass, Mr. Machismo, because I can feel it burning. His husky laugh follows me all the way into the kitchen. I find Cat perched on a stool at the huge marble island in the middle of the gourmet kitchen, staring at an open cookbook on the counter as if it just arrived from outer space. I say, Hey. Without looking up, she asks, Lobsters can feel pain, right? I don't know. I've never asked one. She glances up at me, distress in her eyes. Seriously, this recipe, she points at the book, calls for a live lobster to be thrown into boiling water. That's like torture. Your warped sense of morality is torture. Where do you think those juicy steaks you like so much come from? Murdered cows. Cat puts her hands over her ears. Stop it. I'll have nightmares. I fake a dying cow staggering around the kitchen. Moo, I moan loudly. Cut it out. I stop when I realize she's freaking out. I cross to where she's sitting and give her a hug. Oh, honey, I say, patting her silky dark hair. It must be tough going through life with half a brain and a too big heart. I don't even know why we're friends, she sighs, pushing me away. I gently smooth her hair off her forehead. Because Chloe only blows rainbows and sunshine up your ass, and you need someone to bring you back down to reality once in a while. You're hopeless. Thank you. Can we go now? I smile. Yes. Where's Nico? She hops off the stool. In the studio, working on some new tracks. He probably won't be done until late, so we have hours and hours to smother little Abby in auntie love. A smothering we shall go. I link my arm through hers, and we head back out to the car. The drive from Kat and Nico's in Hollywood to Chloe and AJ's in Laurel Canyon takes about 30 minutes in traffic. By the time we get there, it's dark and my stomach is grumbling. I skipped breakfast and only had a salad for lunch. We should have brought food, I say, pulling into the driveway. The house is much more modest than Kat's, but still sprawling in comparison to the average home. Kat says, No need. AJ said Chloe's mother has brought so much food over there's not enough space for it. I shut the car off and turned to look at Kat. Chloe's mother doesn't cook. She waves a hand at me. When I say Chloe's mother, you know I mean their housekeeper. Same thing. Chloe's mother isn't anywhere near the same thing as their housekeeper. You're right, Kat says, getting out of the car. Their housekeeper has a soul. Chuckling, I follow her to the front door. You're in fine form tonight. Everything okay? Yep. She answers a little too quickly. Avoiding my eyes, she knocks on the front door.
Chloe opens it before I can force Kat to tell me the truth.
Girls!
Chloe throws her arms around the both of us. When she pulls away, she's beaming. Even in a ratty t-shirt and sweats with no makeup and her blonde hair pulled into a sloppy ponytail, she looks stunning.
How are you?
I'm fine. I look pointedly at Kat. But this one is only pretending she is. Kat snaps. Hello, pot, meet kettle. She barges past Chloe into the house. Chloe and I look at each other.
Uh-oh, says Chloe.
I lower my voice.
Do you think she and Nico had a fight?
She hasn't said anything to me.
You?
Not a word. We'll get it out of her, though. In a normal tone, I say, now where's that gorgeous baby of yours? Chloe giggles.
With her daddy, of course, where she always is. Come on in.
I step inside the house. Warmth and a profusion of scents hit me. Baked bread and baby powder and fresh flowers. A pleasant mélange of homey goodness. Chloe shuts the door and then leads me through the entryway into the living room, where we find Kat standing silently in front of the rocking chair AJ is sitting in. More correctly, the rocking chair AJ is stuffed into. His huge frame overflows from all sides, threatening to crush the thing. His eyes are closed. His head lolls to one side. His mouth is slightly open, and he's softly snoring. His sleeping daughter is cradled in his big, tattooed arms. Kat turns to us. Her eyes are bright with tears. She makes a motion with her open hands. Look at this, would you? And turns and heads for the kitchen. Chloe and I share a smile. We tiptoe past AJ and the baby, careful not to wake them. Thankfully, the kitchen is on the other side of the house, separated from the living room by the dining room and the den, so we can talk without disturbing the two sleeping beauties. When we walk into the kitchen, Kat already has her head stuck inside the fridge.
Do you have any white wine?
No, I have something better.
Chloe reaches past Kat and pulls out a frosty pitcher full of pale yellow liquid.
I made margaritas.
Oh, thank God, moans Kat.
You're an angel. Gimme, gimme.
Go sit, both of you.
Chloe motions with her chin to the kitchen table.
I'll get us set up.
Honey, you should be resting, not waiting on us.
I protest, trying to take the pitcher from Chloe's hands. She lightly smacks my hands away, laughing.
I had a baby, Grandma, not a heart transplant. I feel fine.
I'm pretty sure you're abnormal, though. I watch her with narrowed eyes to make sure she's not overextending herself as she gets glasses from the cupboard and pours two drinks. She sets the pitcher on the table, empties a bag of tortilla chips into a big bowl, and puts that out along with some freshly made guacamole.
Ta-da!
She says, grinning like a maniac.
It's just like we're at Lulu's.
Except there's no hideous mariachi music, and you're not drinking. Notes Kat.
Not wasting any time, she slurps her margarita.
Yeah, I've got to figure out the whole breastfeeding versus alcohol consumption thing. I can't have a drink if Abby needs to eat within a few hours, and considering she always needs to eat within a few hours, I'm pretty much out of luck.
Chloe smiles.
Not that I mind. I'd make that trade-off any day.
I take a seat at the round wooden kitchen table and reach for my drink. How are you not even tired? You look like you just got back from vacation. Chloe's smile grows soft. Her blue eyes glow with warmth.
Turns out the drummer from Bad Habit is a natural-born baby whisperer. Believe it or not, I'm sleeping almost all the way through the night because every time Abby makes the slightest peep, he picks her up and she goes quiet. Even when I'm breastfeeding, she always looks right at him and has to be holding his finger. He's doing everything from changing diapers to giving her a bath. He's been amazing.
I'm a little surprised by this information.
He can do all that?
Chloe nods. The mobility and independence training he's been getting since the operation has been incredible. He's taken to it like a duck to water. I honestly think there isn't anything he couldn't also do when he was sighted.
She smiles.
Except drive. Though as far as he's concerned, the jury's still out on that.
Oh, sweetie, I say softly, reaching out to squeeze her hand. I'm so happy for you.
Me too.
There's something strange in Kat's voice that makes Chloe and me look at her. She inhales a long, trembling breath and then guzzles the rest of her margarita.
Kat? Says Chloe, reaching for her hand. What's wrong?
No. She shakes her head. I'm not raining on your parade.
My parade is your parade, says Chloe.
Talk.
It's really not a big deal.
Don't make me beat it out of you.
I'm fine, honestly.
Cut the crap, interrupts Chloe.
We're family.
Talk. Her hands shaking, Kat pours herself another margarita. Then she blows out a hard breath, sweeps her hair off her face, and looks at us.
Nico and I have been trying to get pregnant, and it's not happening. I got my period today, and I'm... because of what happened before, I'm afraid there might be something wrong with me.
She looks at the tabletop. In a quieter voice, she says,
I'm afraid I won't be able to give Nico the family he wants, and then...
She trails off into silence. Her face is pale and somber. I feel every ounce of her pain, exactly as if it were my own.
And then you'll adopt,
I say gently. She looks up and meets my eyes. She whispers,
That's what he said. But...
No buts. If he's on board with that idea, there's no problem. Have you seen a doctor yet? Kat shakes her head.
I've been too freaked out to go. I know it's stupid, but I'm worried what I might find out.
We'll make an appointment for next week and go with you, Chloe declares. I agree. Denial isn't the way to deal with this, sweetie. Kat looks at me. Her big green eyes flash with sudden anger.
Excuse me, but you're in no position to be talking to me about denial, Grace.
I'm taken aback by the force in her tone. What do you mean?
I mean this whole Brody situation you're so determined to pretend isn't happening.
Enunciating every word, I say calmly, There is nothing happening between me and Brody.
You can deny it all you want. But I've never seen you look at a man like that.
I can't resist. I have to know. Even though this is dangerous territory, I'm going in.
Like what?
Hopefully. I laugh. Honey, the only time I've ever looked at a man hopefully is right before I unzip his pants for the first time, and I'm praying he's packing more than 5 inches.
Kat shakes her head. Fine, don't admit it, but it doesn't change what I saw.
Maybe you need to go get your eyes checked.
In a flat, no-nonsense tone, Chloe says, You realize we know you too well for you to get away with this tough chick act you're trying to pull, right?
Kat and I look at her in surprise. Chloe rarely calls anyone out on their shit, and when she does, she feels so guilty afterward she always apologizes and says she didn't mean it. Right now she doesn't look guilty. She actually looks a little mad. Maybe being a mother is bringing out the tiger in her.
It's not an act, Chloe. I actually am very tough.
She retorts.
Only on the outside.
Impressed, Kat blinks at her.
Go on, girl. Preach.
Encouraged by the traitor, Chloe leans forward.
I've seen the way you look at Brody, too. And not only that, but I saw the way you looked at Abby when you first held her. And the way you looked at her when you just came in.
She stares at me with a challenge in her blue eyes. I say dryly, "Your large, beast-like child is uncommonly pretty, Chloe. I like pretty things, that's all." Chloe scoops up a handful of chips and chucks them at me. They smack me on the chest before I can duck out of the way. "Hey! Take that back!" I brushed the crumbs off my shirt. "You're right. That was unnecessary. She isn't beast-like. She's beautiful."
"Not that, you nincompoop!"
Even though Chloe is trying to fry me with her eyeballs, I can't help myself. I break into a grin and look at Kat.
"Nincompoop. Oh boy, now she's breaking out the big guns."
Chloe, aggravated to the point that she pounds her fist on the table, making the silverware clatter, growls,
"Stop trying to pretend you don't have a heart."
That stops me cold. I sit back against my chair and exhale. Blood pounds in my temples. "I'm happy, Chloe."
"You're not happy. You're safe. They're two different things. You said that to me once, and it was totally true. So now I'm saying it to you, and I'm going to say something else that you're not going to like, but you really need to hear. Are you ready?"
"Absolutely not." Chloe ignores that. She leans even farther over the table and looks into my eyes. "You didn't die in that car crash with your parents, Grace. You just stopped living."
6. Sucker punch to the gut. My throat closes. I swallow, but I can't find any air. Every once in a while, Princess Buttercup pulls a gem like that one out of the clouds and knocks me flat on my ass. I look back and forth between her and Kat. "You two have already talked about this, haven't you?"
Kat remains silent. Chloe lifts a shoulder.
"Houston, we have a problem."
"Well, I don't want to talk about this."
"Tough shit," says Chloe softly, holding my gaze. "We've let you get away with hiding for way too long. You're my friend, and I love you, and I'm sick of watching you use sex as a shield. You distract men with your friendly vagina so they don't have a chance to get to know you, so you don't have a chance to get attached. So you'll always be alone because you think you should be. Well, I've got news for you. That's a shitty, empty, pointless way to spend a life. And you're better than that, Grace. You deserve happiness. But the only way you're ever going to get it is if you let someone in."
Kat leans toward me, so now I've got two meddling harpies up in my grill.
"Like Brody, for instance. Or Marcus. Hell, even Barney seems to have the hots for you."
I spread my hands flat on the table. I inhale a slow, deep breath, contemplating what I've just heard and how much I should tell them. Finally, I realize I have to tell them the truth. The whole ugly truth. They want something for me that I can never have, and until I tell them everything, they won't stop pestering me. Not since they both found their happily ever afters and decided I should get one too. So, here goes. I take another breath and begin. "I love you guys. I love that you're worried about me. I hear what you're saying, I do. And now I'm going to tell you both to mind your own business, because neither of you will ever, could ever, possibly understand what it's like to wake up one day with no family, no memory, and no idea who you are or where you are or even what your own goddamn name is." Kat says softly,
"Honey."
I hold up a hand to stop her. "No. This is the last thing I'll say, and then we're not going to ever mention this topic again. It took me years after the accident to not want to kill myself. I lived through hell, and I made it out alive, but I could go back there any minute." Chloe blinks.
"Go back? What do you mean by that?"
I blow out a hard breath.
With the kind of amnesia I have, and the damage to my hippocampus, I could lose all my memories again. My new memories, the ones I've made since the accident. I could wake up one day and it would all be gone. Like that. I snap my fingers. Again. Horrified, Chloe and Kat gasp.
Oh my God, chokes Kat. You never told us that.
Well, for obvious reasons, it's not